big burly men beating their chests. Sometimes it's tough women beating their tits.
Radio Draw.
On this Thursday night, I, Josh Hadley, am the best of the best. But my co-host, Cecil T, might be the best of the best of the best of the best.
I am the worst of the best.
That's very true. Peter, I don't know, he's definitely not the best of the best. I think he's Gina Gershon in part three.
Hey, she was an awesome character. You shut your mouth.
For this, if I haven't laid the groundwork well enough, this best of the best retrospective, we have the man I like to torture with all of these weird retrospectives, Mike White, joining us as well.
I am the Chris Penn of this podcast.
Oh, shit. That means you get killed in part two, then.
Jeez, spoiler, people.
The trailer. It's the first line of the trailer. Did you kill Travis Brickley? Before that, I do need to tell people, go to adamandeve.com. Use the promo code DROME to get 10 free gifts. You'll get 6 free DVDs, a free mystery gift, a gift for him, a gift for her, and free U.S. shipping, all for using the promo code DROME at adamandeve.com. Now, tonight we're going to be talking about the Best of the Best franchise, and we will ultimately decide what Best of the Best is the best of the best. This is a franchise that I don't think a lot of people remember is a franchise. Two theatrical films, both which bombed hard, and then two direct-to-video films that are barely connected to the first two. Before we get into each individual film, what did you think of the franchise as a whole?
I really enjoyed it. I had a lot of fun last weekend watching all four of those films.
I like the franchise as a whole because each movie, you're getting almost a different like subgenre of action. You know, it's they all kind of varied from it was revenge. It was, well, I mean, it went from like kind of a kung fu Karate Kid kind of movie to a little bit more of an underground fight club to like revenge to, just more straight up action. So crime thriller. It really ran the gamut, and it kind of made it like interesting to watch each one to see which way they were going to go with it.
Just like Cecil said, it's awesome how each one is a different subgenre, and it honestly does it surprisingly well. Like, the first movie is a genuinely good tournament fighter movie. The second one is like a great blood sport, exploitation-y kind of thing. Third one's got this, it almost reminds me of the movie Stone Cold with Brian Bosworth. Like, it has just a great action exploitation kind of vibe. And then the fourth one is like a crime thriller, and they all do it really well. I enjoyed the hell out of the whole series.
Well, let's go back to 1989 and start with the first one. Best of the Best, directed by Robert Radler, a director who, I don't know, even though he did this after the Best of the Best movies, he's mainly known as a Mighty Morphin Power Rangers director. He's directed almost 40 episodes of various Power Rangers series. So I guess the Best of the Best films primed him for all the goofy fighting. I saw the first Best of the Best film kind of as the Bad News Bears of Taekwondo, really. Because if you think about it, you've got the coach who's trying to redeem himself. You have the veteran who screwed up in the past and is looking for redemption. You've got the newcomer who is all arrogant and thinks he's undefeatable. You have the smartass. This is the Bad News Bears for Taekwondo.
I was really surprised by the quality of the stars that are in this. Louise Fletcher showing up as either his mom or his mother-in-law, and of course, James Earl Jones as the coach. I was like, what? I'd never heard of this movie before you had asked me to take a look at these films. And to see these two people in here, I was like, okay. And then Chris Penn showing up, it's like, what is happening here? And of course, Eric Roberts, just amazing. And his mullet is just fantastic.
His mullet is glorious. I have to say that,
oh, God, yeah. I have to say I got him mixed up a little bit with one of the other guys, now I'm going to blank on his name.
Sonny?
Not Virgil. Sonny. I got to mix up with Sonny. Like, when Sonny's working on the cars in Detroit, I was just like, oh yeah, there's Eric Roberts. And I was like, no, that's not Eric Roberts. That's another guy. But yeah, it was nice. It was a really good team dynamic. And I was very surprised by some of the places that this seemed to go to, especially that making South Korea the bad guys was pretty interesting.
Well, and you mentioned the cast. Outside of the ones you already mentioned, okay, we got Eric Roberts, James Earl Jones, Sally Kirkland. You've got Chris Penn, John Dye, Tom Everett, Louise Fletcher, Simon Ree. You got Kane Hodder as a mullet-wearing thug in a bar. This thing's got just a cast that you go, what the hell?
The first Best of the Best is great. It definitely was inspired. I mean, it had to have been influenced by Karate Kid. I don't know all the history behind it, but it just feels like it is a much grander scale because it's really focusing on more of the team as opposed to just one person. And the stuff that they go through is really good. And then finally, like the last half hour when they're doing all the fights, it's just freaking awesome. The fight sequences and the choreography and everything that they did for the tournament and all that stuff was just, it was really freaking good. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It's like a genuinely good movie. Like Mike said, the cast in it is just ridiculous. Like this is not like a little no budget piece of crap movie. This was a genuinely like theatrically released good movie.
Well, and you mentioned that the fighting in the tournament, one of the interesting things is they don't win. That kind of threw me because you assume, you know, the underdogs are going to come from behind and get victory. They don't win. Did that take you by surprise at all?
Big time, because that's from, you know, the thing where, oh, you know, the heroes are going to win. And then you're like, oh, well, they're not the best of the best, I guess. And it kind of it was good. It made it more real. It's like, okay, well, sometimes they don't win.
Yeah, it was almost like Rocky in a way where Rocky doesn't actually win at the end.
I was really surprised that Tommy Lee was the last fighter. I thought for sure that this was Eric Roberts' film, even though it's this team dynamic and everything. And they spend a lot of time with Eric Roberts, a lot of time with Tommy Lee. But really, it's like Eric Roberts is, you know, the nice guy and Chris Penn is this douchebag and stuff. And so I thought there'd be a lot more with those guys. And then when the Philip Ree character, Tommy Lee, ends up being the final fighter, I was like, oh, okay, this is kind of really Tommy Lee's story, and he's the guy with the big conflict. I know that, you know, Eric Roberts had the bad shoulder and the convenient car accident with his kid that takes him out of the competition for a little bit and all the conflict that comes around that. But really, it ends up becoming the Tommy Lee story right at the very end, which is funny considering the way that this whole franchise goes over the next three films.
I loved that Eric Roberts had the most majestic mullet I have ever seen. But besides mullets, as Mike and Cecil have said, it really is a genuinely good film. Like, it doesn't feel cheap. It doesn't feel like some crappy knockoff. There are some Karate Kid elements, but it really does stand on its own as its own tournament fighter film. There's a lot of really great story elements to it. The cast is just fantastic. Like, the people you wouldn't even expect to be in a movie like that. Like, before I watched the Best of the Best films, I had never expected to see Eric Roberts as a mullet sporting martial artist, or Chris Penn as, like, also, you know, a martial artist in his own right, more of the cocky variety. It was awesome. It kicked ass.
You guys pointed out that it's a genuinely good film, and I'm not disagreeing. Audiences in 1989 did, and so did critics. Critics lambasted the film, and the film only made $1.7 million of its $6.5 million budget. So the film was a bomb with critics and a bomb at the box office. So despite the fact that we all liked it, it was not seen very promisingly in 89.
I hate this world.
I hear that Eric Roberts is actually very much into martial arts in real life, which I never really would have pegged him for that.
That is one thing in this one and the second one. You can see it's Eric Roberts doing most of the stunts. That's not a stunt double, so he is wicked in shape in these movies.
Yeah, he is.
So yeah, this bombed at the box office quite hard. It took until 1993 for them to make the sequel, simply titled Best of the Best 2. also bombed at the box office, making $6 million of its $10 million budget. Still, it made $6 million, but it cost more. I like the second film the best. And here's the big thing about Best of the Best 2 and the critics. Eric Roberts specifically knew that Leonard Maltin tore the first film to shreds. He actually met Leonard Maltin at the premiere and said, "This one makes up for the first one." I don't know what Leonard Maltin's review was, but I think that says that Eric Roberts was rather proud of Best of the Best 2. What did you think about this one?
I liked it. I don't know if I consider this one the best one for me, but it definitely was the most traditional action film, I guess. I really like, again, that kind of Tommy Lee is really taking the stage in this one, especially when he is fighting through all of these different guys near the end of the film. Chris Penn being such an asshole in the first movie and kind of a unredemptive asshole.
Yeah,
like,
he's still
never
an asshole in this movie, yeah, too.
And so I'm kind of glad when he gets killed. But the thing that I was really surprised about was Wayne Newton just being such an amazing sleazeball. I mean, of course, I'm a huge fan of The Adventures of Fort Fairlane, so I know this guy's range. But seeing him in this, he was so great. And I also have to say, I imagine that director Robert Radler must be friends with Eddie Bunker, because this is the only time I've seen Eddie Bunker show up more than once. And to see him as two different characters, worlds apart, you know, Las Vegas and Detroit, to see him show up again in this one, I was like, oh, okay, that's kind of nice. I guess maybe like Eddie and Kane Hodder, and, you know, he's got like his regulars or something.
Yeah, because Kane Hodder shows up in this one, too. He's the door guard that Eric Roberts stabs through the hand with a pen. But then this one also has a cast that just, you go, what the hell? So you've got Eric Roberts, Chris Penn, and Philip Rhee all returning. And then you've got Ralph Mueller, Meg Foster, Wayne Newton, Sonny Landham, and Simon Rhee has a very small role as Dehan from the first film again. You go, what the hell is with these casts? How do they get the casts for these things?
This was one that I saw way back in the early 90s, and I remember liking it, but I haven't seen it since, so I don't really have a lot to say about it. I just remember that I liked it, and I thought it was cool, and I remember the whole kind of Fight Club angle to it, but not much else.
Well, because in this one, the first film was more like I said, the Bad News Bears for Taekwondo. This is more of a straight-out action movie. In fact, I was surprised that this one was theatrical, because when you watch it, it has a very early 90s DTV feel to it, and I mean that in a good way. Now, in this one, you're in underground pit fighting that results in death, and you've got hitmen and a conspiracy, and this one is much more of a straight-out action movie than the first one was.
I thought part two, while part one was a really solid film, I found part two to be a lot more entertaining. If you want to see what Sonny Landham is like, according to a lot of actors that have worked with him, he's pretty much just playing that. In fact, I'm just going to venture a guess that he was really that drunk and really puking on screen. That was incredibly entertaining and hilarious. And Ralph Mueller made for just such a good, not Schwarzenegger villain. Overall, the action is great. The pacing is awesome. I'm a little disappointed that the mullet didn't make a return. But
Eric Roberts has short hair in this one.
Yeah, that's kind of, it was so beautiful. But the second one is really entertaining. It's a solid action film, and I really loved it. I love the score by Michael David Frank. That's almost exactly like his score from Hard to Kill.
There's a couple of things with this one that I find really strange. One, they say in the credits, introducing Ralph Mueller. He'd been in three films and a TV series before this, so I don't know where they get off introducing Ralph Mueller to us. Then there's also the fact that Meg Foster is Eric Roberts' girlfriend in this, and she never betrays them. Why do you cast Meg Foster and you don't have her betray somebody at some point? Isn't that like casting Malcolm McDowell as a good guy? It just goes against type, doesn't it?
Yeah, Meg Foster she really comes off as, and I don't mean it as like an insult towards her or anything, but she's just a very cold looking person. Like those piercing blue eyes and just the general, she comes across as somebody who will stab you in the back. And it's so weird to see her playing well, a perfectly decent wife. She's pretty much playing the same role that she played in Relentless. And even in that one, like, it's weird. You're expecting her to team up with the serial killer.
No, it makes no sense at all. And then just sometimes I forget she's even in the movie. You know, she just kind of shows up almost randomly. It was like, oh, she's back. Okay. And every time she did show up, I kept waiting for her to be like, you know, in Brachus's arms or something and be like, ha ha ha, we have fooled you. But yeah, no. So.
Well, and then there's also the fact of some of the story elements in this one. This is something you're going to see in the next two films as well, that a lot of these don't seem to be made like they're made as a franchise. Because in this one, all of a sudden, Tommy Lee has a different history. In the first film we saw, he had an Asian mother, an Asian father, because he's Chinese, and an Asian brother that Dae-han killed in the ring. Now we find out his parents died at an early age and he was raised by Sonny Landham's family. So his adopted parents in this are American Indian. Okay.
Well, he does say, don't ask.
Right. But then they're going to go contradict that in the next film, though, as well. So that's why it's like these don't seem to be like they were made with any real continuity in mind. And technically, at the end of this one, Tommy Lee gets the Coliseum. He owns that multi-million-dollar underground pit fighting business when he kills Ralph Mueller. Even though I would think there'd be a police investigation, considering he just killed a man in front of 100 witnesses in an underground illegal act, and I'm sure the IRS would be interested in the money the Coliseum makes, or am I just overthinking an action movie?
You're overthinking an action movie.
This film, it failed at the box office and with critics again. So,
oh, man.
So all of a sudden, it took until 1995 where Philip Rhee took the reins. Philip Rhee co-wrote the first film, he produced the second film, and then for 3 and 4, he both wrote and directed. For this third one, this one wasn't even originally a best of the best film. He found a script he liked called No Turning Back about a black Marine that comes back to a southern town and finds it's taken over with neo-Nazis. He bought that script and rewrote it as a best of the best film. So that's why there's no mention of Alex, Eric Roberts' character, anymore. There's no mention of any of the other characters. Tommy Lee now is the only character from the other movies that will continue on in this franchise. But in this one, we've got neo-Nazis taking over a small southern town. And again, a cast that you go, what? You got Philip Rhee, Christopher McDonald, Gina Gershon, D. Wallace Stone, Mark Ralston, Arlie Ermey as a neo-Nazi leader, Kane Hodder again, this time as a machine gun-wielding neo-Nazi. How do these films keep getting these casts? Christ!
Well, granted, Dee Wallace, I think she only shows up for, what, one scene?
She has three scenes and two three locations. She has two scenes at the trailer and one in the diner.
I only really remembered her in the trailer, and I was just like, is she going to come back? But I have to say that they say Tommy Lee's name so many times in this film, and every time they did, I would have to pause and think, okay, that's the Asian guy. That's not the drummer from Motley Crue. So.
Right.
That's not the guy that beat up Pamela Anderson.
And it was weird because he doesn't even show up until, what, like 20 minutes into the film? Like, I think I even paused it when he finally shows up. I was like, oh, he's in this. Okay. Because you have this whole thing of these kids going on this bus to the school and they're going to sing, and there's this black
Gershon
preacher.
Is their teacher.
Yeah. There's this black preacher who's getting killed by these neo-Nazis. And I'm just, okay, I'm enjoying this film. And then Tommy Lee shows up and I was like, oh yeah. All right. This guy's in it.
That's right. It's a best of the best film.
Yeah.
Tommy Lee showing up in his best Cobra impression.
And I have to say, it really, once he got there, it really worked for me. I totally enjoyed this one. I especially like the, you know, little small town touches, him being the clown at the dunk tank and everything. And there is so much action in this one that he is beating up people constantly. And I did appreciate that.
Well, and you mentioned the clown. He's in full clown makeup. The nose, the giant floppy shoes, and beating the crap out of neo-Nazis that are harassing Gina Gershon at the city, at the county fair. It's a glorious scene for how ridiculous it is, and they play it. They never play it tongue-in-cheek, do they? They play it 100% straight.
Hell, you want to talk about a weird playing against type, too. You know, we talked about Meg Foster not betraying anybody.
Christopher McDonald's a good guy!
Yeah, so nice! I kept waiting for him to, like, turn into an asshole at some point.
I kept thinking the sheriff was going to be in on with the neo-Nazis or with Arlie Ermey or something, and it's like, no, he's just a straight-out good guy.
Yeah, oh, man,
really,
same
really
here.
Nice
like,
guy.
How is Shooter McGavin not a bad guy?
Exactly.
Three is definitely my favorite of the bunch. I just had really enjoyed this movie. Going back and watching it again, I enjoyed it just as much as I remembered. And like Mike said, the scene where he's beating the crap out of the Nazis in the clown outfit is hilarious. He for some reason the youngest kid, the new neo-Nazi, he all of a sudden is like a badass. Like he's the one that has the knife and he's the one that keeps coming back to fight him, and he keeps kind of winding he's the one that sees the really bad neo-Nazi kill Arlie Ermey, and but then he doesn't say anything, and so you keep thinking that he's maybe going to, like, all right,
switch
maybe
sides.
He's going to finally realize. Now he just keeps staying bad the whole time, and he's just an ass, you know. Arlie Ermey was freaking fantastic, because so hearing him, you know, and we will drive out, you know, just that freaking voice of his, just being
the gunnery sergeant Hartman voice.
Right, oh, yeah. Right. Being a friggin', you know, neo-Nazi leader. And then he ends up being like the sympathetic neo-Nazi leader. He's like, well, he's bad, but at least he's not as bad as these guys.
Yeah, because he wanted just separate. He wanted, there were the mud people to live in their own area and the whites to live here. Mark Ralston wanted to kill the mud people and wanted to create a race war. So, yeah, it's hard to say, but Arlie Ermey was the sympathetic neo-Nazi.
Sympathetic neo-Nazi. I kind of, the only thing that kind of got me a little bit was they showed the neo-Nazis getting all this like high-tech military-grade equipment. They had a friggin' minigun.
They had a rocket launcher.
They had a rocket launcher. I really was expecting something with that, where they just use the rocket launcher on one of the buildings, or the minigun on like the main neo-Nazi compound or something. And it really, like, it all just kind of went into him beating the crap out of people. And usually
they did,
if he was shooting
launcher, they did use the rocket launcher to try and blow up Gina Gershon in the school bus. She avoided the rocket launcher in the coolest way possible. The driver's side window of the school bus had been shot out, and the rocket launcher went straight
through
it, and she opened the door, and it goes and hits the building behind her.
Oh, man, that made me laugh my ass off.
And
that's so good.
And Gina Gershon, too, I like the fact that she was not, like, a pushover character. Like, the freaking gigantic neo-Nazi came.
The one that's trying to rape her?
It was trying to rape her, yeah. And she's hitting him with a frying pan and like smashing him over the head with vases. Like she was not just going to be like, and fell back. And, you know, like, no, she like fought back, and she was doing, you know, if there were less guys there, she might've done a little bit better, but you know,
yeah,
thankfully,
she was awesome.
You know, she was awesome. And then Tommy showed up and, you know, beat the crap out of everybody. And, you know, it's a lot of fun. It's got great action sequences. I thought Philip Rees directing, I thought was genuinely solid. He knew how to shoot an action scene. He knew how to keep the movie progressing forward. I also like the fact that the first 20 minutes or so was total character development. It was setting everything up. It's like, okay, this is what's going on. We're seeing all this stuff. You know, Tommy comes into play.
Like Mike pointed out, Tommy Lee doesn't even show up till almost 20 minutes in.
Yeah, he doesn't show up for quite a while. And then, you know, he kind of shows up, and he's the character that, if you've seen the previous movies, you already do know a little bit about him, so he doesn't need as much of an introduction. So,
well, I don't know. They changed his backstory yet again for this one. Now, all of a sudden, yeah, he has an Asian sister now, which he have in the second one.
No, he did not.
He said,
well, he could have.
Exactly.
Still,
ask is a very broad term, Mike.
Don't ask,
that's how
don't
you
tell.
Know that it was,
he only visited
once
in a while.
That it was just taken from another script.
Yeah, this was obvious that it was taken from a pre-existing script that was not a best of the best film.
I'm going to say that one is, to me, the best of the best of the best. I love this one. I love the neo-Nazi angle. I love how it starts out with actual solid character development. And it's like, it starts out as like a totally serious movie. And then Tommy Lee struts into town looking like Stallone from Cobra. And he's just kicking all kinds of ass. And Gina Gershon was awesome, and Drake from Aliens was great, and I loved Arlie Ermey, how he does have kind of a character change where he seems like he's, you know, very much the, you know, the Adolf Hitler, the front runner, and then he's kind of the one that doesn't really want violence. You know, he it's still pretty bad what he wants. He wants separation of races, but he doesn't want to actually hurt anybody. So that was a nice little twist that, you know, he was kind of a false villain. Overall, I loved this one. It was, it really had an awesome pace to it. The finale, the, with, you know, the knife fight between Tommy Lee and the main, you know, the Drake. I keep forgetting his character's name, but you guys know which one I'm talking about.
The actor is Warren Ralston. At the end.
Yeah, that's a fight where everybody's like surrounding them and they're having the knife fight. That was, that kicked so much ass. And in case my phone dies at any second, I'm just gonna say that I thought the fourth one was really weak overall.
And you got Kane Hodder showing up again, this time getting shot by Christopher McDonald on a school bus.
And again, he was doing something pretty cool here. Yeah, like in the first one, he's the mulleted biker. In the second one, he's the banana yellow blazer wearing doorman. And in this one, he's on top of a school bus shooting a machine gun. So, yeah, they got Jason Voorhees doing some pretty cool stuff in these movies.
Right after she shot this, I mean, literally a week later, Gina Gershon went on to start shooting Showgirls. She has talked about her pre-fame, her pre-Showgirls career in not the best light.
Yeah.
I don't think she was phoning this in. She looked like she was genuinely trying here.
She was really good in Best of the Best Three. I honestly thought she, I would say she was one of my favorite parts of the movie. I thought her character was great. She really had awesome chemistry with the Tommy Lee character. And she was like, if we have any feminists that listen to the show, watch this movie for Gina Gershon's character. You'll be surprised as to what kind of women are in these types of movies. It's not just big burly men beating their chests. Sometimes it's tough women beating their tits.
Yeah, and it's funny that she would put down some of the movies that she made pre-Showgirls. I mean, because you know, there's just a handful of movies that she made since then where she didn't feel like she was phoning it in for me. So it was nice to see her in this where I still considered her trying, you know, so that it was nice to really see her in this. And, you know, yeah, she's got a lot of passion. It's interesting the way her character changes and that, you know, she's kind of mean to Tommy Lee at one point. And, you know, then we have the nice falling in love montage and everything. So, you know, it all works out in the end, but she is a very dynamic female character, which I appreciated.
This film was a moderate success on video. Then, doing the same thing that he did for part three, Philip Rhee would also write and direct Best of the Best Four Without Warning, again from a pre-existing script that he just rewrote to include Tommy Lee. Again, they've changed his backstory. Now he has a daughter and a dead wife. So, and the reason I say that he couldn't have had the daughter afterwards, the daughter's sixth birthday is coming up here. Well, the daughter did not exist in the last film, which was only 4 years earlier. So they've changed his backstory yet again, but this time Tommy Lee is fighting the Russian mob who are trying to, I guess counterfeit is the wrong word, they're trying to illegally print real American currency. And again, we've got a cast. We got Philip Rhee, Ernie Hudson, Tobin Bell, you got Art LaFleur, you got Sven-Ole Thorsen, another fantastic cast for a late 90s direct-to-video film. I do agree with Peter, this is the weakest of the four, I'll say that. What did you think of Without Warning?
Oh, I don't know. I found this one to be kind of a tough sit. It didn't have the flair that the first three had. I just, the whole time, it felt like a really generic 90s film. It just had, it reeked of everything that annoyed me about the 90s. Just everybody either came across like they were from a Backstreet Boys or a Spice Girls music video, just with the shiny clothing and just the over-enunciated way of delivering lines, and just everything just felt so smug and overly lit with that very the soap opera, like it had a very soap opera look to it, and the action felt kind of stagnant. It was cool to see Tobin Bell pre-Jigsaw, and I love Sven-Ole Thorsen, but other than that, I don't know, this one was kind of a tough sit, and it just made me want to go back and watch, you know, three or two.
You seem to have forgotten Leprechaun 4's Jessica Collins was also in this movie.
Which one was she again?
She was Karina, the blonde.
Oh, the completely ineffectual Russian mob hitwoman that could not do a damn thing right?
You are correct. She was still in it. And she's on the cover, too.
Oh, and also the principal from the Breakfast Club is a priest.
All right.
That's right. Best of the Best Four, I was really bummed. It's not a terrible movie, but the thing was, I was faking sick one day from work. I was home, and normally if I'm home and I'm not, this is pre-baby and everything, I would just sit and just watch Netflix movies all day. Surprise. Both of these were streaming. And so I was like, all right, well, I watched 3, and 3 was amazing. And so I was like, oh, well, 4 is also done by Philip Rhee, and there's Russian mobsters. This is going to be great. And then I watched it, and it was just okay. Like, it didn't have the same energy that the previous one did, and it just didn't flow as well. It was a lot of, like, downtime, and it wasn't so, like, I don't mind when an action movie has like a story that goes along, but it was just like the story with this wasn't really all that interesting. So when there was the downtime, it was kind of like you're just sitting there waiting for the next action scene. It was a cool cast, and it was neat to see that this kind of continued on with Philip Rhee's character. But it's definitely the weakest of the four, and kind of sad that the franchise ended here.
I'm a little weird on this one for Sven. He seems like he's having a lot of fun, but he also kind of seems like after Mallrats and all this, he kind of seems like he didn't want to be in this movie, but then he's so almost over the top.
Yeah, I wish I had talked to him about this one, and I was supposed to talk to him again yesterday, but then he ended up saying he was going out of town, so I would have asked him about this film. It's always great to see him show up. No matter what he's in, I always enjoy seeing him. He's usually, in the background, so I was really glad to see him in this so prominently. And I thought for sure, like, his boss was going to take him out way earlier, and that he wouldn't have the glorious death that he has in this film. So I was, that made up for a lot of things. Going along with what the guys have said, I'm not really feeling it that much. I kind of wish Tobin Bell, for some reason, has a little bit of a Mark Rolston look to me. So I was kind of hoping that he would do like a simple Simon from Die Hard 3 and be like the brother of the bad guy from the previous film, and come back and he would be the Simon Gruber character.
Unfortunately, in this one, they saddled him with the psychopathic Punisher Warzone kind of brother, that you've got the controlled brother that's running everything, and then he has total blinders on to what an idiotic psychopath his brother is, which I think is cliched dynamic.
Yeah, Face Off did the same thing with Nicolas Cage's doofus of a brother.
Yeah, I don't like that.
Castor and Pollux, yeah.
Lockout did the same thing. And I find that to be just a really cliched character development that they go with. And I don't know, saddling Tommy Lee with a daughter now, even though it's again changing the history, I thought was kind of a mistake, because the movie at certain points is flowing along nicely, and then they have to do the mob finds out about his daughter and his daughter is in danger, cliched subplot. And I don't know. This one didn't sit right with me either. This one is the weakest of the four. I don't know. This one I didn't enjoy as much. It had another great cast. Ernie Hudson doing his best. I think I'm Captain Sisko, and not quite pulling it off. And also, it was cliched as hell. It was so obvious when What's-Her-Face from Southland Tales said that the cops are involved in this, and then Tommy Lee's friend is the good cop that's trying to get to the bottom of it. Right away, you go, he's the traitor. And then when he betrays Tommy Lee, you're like, yes, that was such an anticlimactic surprise.
It was so anticlimactic because it happened so early on. Like, they should have at least milked it a little bit, but no, it just, you could tell it was coming. It was coming as quickly as you could tell that Meg Foster was going to end up betraying somebody, but never did. So why not, milk it until 30 or 40% into the film, really make the audience believe that the guy might actually be helping Tommy Lee, and then have him Tommy Lee over. I mean, they really missed the mark with that one in a lot of ways.
I will say, though, Tommy Lee pulled a John McClane in this one. Using nothing but a motorcycle, he killed Sven Ole Thorsen, four henchmen, a tanker truck, three motorcycles, and a helicopter, all with a motorcycle. I thought John McClane could not have blown that up even better than that.
That was admittedly pretty goddamn awesome.
But then
although I was just going to say, in three, somehow Tommy Lee jumped up in the air and kicked three people in driving motorcycles.
Yes, I
that was awesome. That was so awesome.
How did that happen? You know,
a foot on each one and then maybe a fist in the middle?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know.
He's just that, you know, he's that goddamn good. He could have killed Dahan in the first film, but he didn't. He's that good.
I kind of wish like Art LaFleur and Paul Gleason had a little bit more to do in this, especially Paul Gleason. I would have loved to have seen him, you know, in the Cheech Marin role from Machete or something, and just kind of help out Tommy Lee with, you know, some shotguns and stuff.
He's basically
a
babysitter the whole movie.
Yeah, yeah. And again, another guy who could betray, you know, you expect Paul Gleason to be an asshole in films, but, you know, he ended up being a nice guy.
This film didn't go so well with critics. I had a hard time finding positive review of Without Warning because people pointed out all of the same things we just did. Great cast, it's well directed, but the story is cliched as hell. And there's some late 90s CG in this. There's a couple of explosions that you go, yes, they really blew up that thing. And then there are a couple more where you go, wow, that was a CG explosion.
That orange helicopter near the beginning of the movie looked so bad.
The one that was picking up the entire
It looked like the Shark and Jaws 3D. It was like clipping toward you.
The plot in this is a little bit weird. Okay, they steal actual U.S. currency software, and they steal U.S. paper so they can really print $100 bills. They have a giant mansion, two helicopters, a fleet of trucks, an entire army of trained guys. I don't think money was a problem. Why would you go to this plot other than the script called for it?
I guess they spent all their money on the mansion, the copters, and the armed guards. They needed more.
Yeah, when they showed their mansion and everything, I was like, now is this the guy who's above these two guys? But no, it seemed like this was the place. And I was like, wait a second, didn't I just see this in Big Hero 6 when the total slacker guy at the college ends up being like the multimillionaire and they show up at his mansion? This doesn't compute at all that these guys are desperate, and I put that in quotation marks, for money. It just seems like maybe counterfeiting is like a hobby for them or something. And they are so well organized when it comes to the counterfeiting stuff, like having so many people, so many computer terminals, and a very efficient operation. Of course, you're not allowed to leave the building and stuff. So I'm wondering, as far as like, do they call in for food? Do they have an on-site cafeteria? Do they have to sign like non-disclosure agreements?
Yeah, you're overthinking it now.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I guess I am.
It's a bad 90s movie. Let's just leave it at that.
Well, I mean, there are a lot of movies that like you're like, yeah, that was great. Oh, wait, that doesn't make sense. So when you do kind of take a step back, a lot of times they don't make sense. And this is one where it's like, it was a movie that was written to be another movie that was shoehorned into a franchise. It's not going to really make a whole lot of sense. So I'm willing to kind of give it some leeway in that capacity.
Do you want
to Three was able to do it well. Four, not so much.
Do you see the progression from, you know, theatrical to direct to video? Do you see that as what this franchise deserved? Or do you recommend this franchise, even with, you know, the complaints we've had about Without Warning, would you recommend this franchise as a whole to people who maybe might not even remember that Best of the Best was a thing?
Absolutely. I mean, because each movie, even the fourth one, like it's still, I think, worth checking out. I mean, definitely the first three I would recommend to people, because they are all good in their own ways. They're seriously, like, they're three damn good movies. So I would not have a problem. Yeah, three damn good movies and one okay movie. So I would not have a problem, you know, recommending that, you know, to anybody who likes action movies.
Hell yeah, I would. I thought it was a blast. I love the first three. While the fourth one may have been weak, I still say check it out if, you know, you're a completist. All of them have their own elements that are fun to watch. Even the fourth one, it's not so great. It's lacking in a lot of ways, but it still has some cool action here and there. The first three, of course, solid. So yeah, I definitely think people should check this series out. I think it's kind of a hidden gem, and people should definitely rediscover it and check it out.
I think I'd heard of Best of the Best, the first film, but that was it. Heard of it and never saw it, so was completely unfamiliar. And it was what, like a month ago, you were telling me about this and talking about how great, you know, oh my god, and then freaking Wayne Newton shows up, and I was just like, okay, sold, I'll watch it, whatever. I would totally recommend this to anybody, and yeah, I had a great time beginning to end. Yeah, there's some weak spots in four and everything, but really, it's a pretty solid franchise, especially compared to other ones where you're going up and down with the quality left and right. And this one, it stays on a fairly even keel, and they kind of set your expectations as far as, like, you're not going to get better and better and better as you go, which I think is what makes three such a nice, pleasant surprise, is that it ends up being, for me, the best of the best of the best.
Yeah, it's one of those rare cases where the third movie actually ends up being, well, not in Josh's case, but in yours, Cecil, and mine, where the third one's the best. Whereas if you look at a lot of film franchises, it's usually by the third or fourth one that it starts to tank. I mean, Terminator 1 and 2.
Terminator
1 and 2, awesome. Terminator 3 and Salvation and Genesis, Geneva Convention, I don't know, shit. Whereas Best of the Best, the first three are great, and the fourth one, it's still pretty watchable, even if it's not so great.
And see, I look at it as, a lot of people don't even realize that there is a third and a fourth one. When I started telling people we were doing this retrospective, they're like, of two films? I'm like, no, there's three and four. What? I send them trailers and that, and they're like, there were sequels? And then they're going, Gina Gershon? What the hell? Ernie Hudson? When it came to three and four, the general thing I got was, I never even knew these existed. And that's because these were not big hits on video. They were put out by a small DTV company. These did not get the penetration that one and two did. Because Best of the Best one, I remember when that came out in theaters, I didn't see it in theaters. I didn't see the first film until HBO. But I remember my friends went out to see it, and this was an HBO staple. And then the second one I didn't see until video. They pushed the video for this one. I think it was Universal was the distributor. Best of the Best 2 was pushed hard on video. And then 3 and 4 just kind of were out there. So I think a lot of people are surprised that this is even a franchise. And Philip Rhee being the only one that is connected to all of them. Now, I reached out to Philip Rhee to try and get an interview for this episode. And the only reason he declined was he didn't have time. He's shooting a movie at the moment. But he did let one little piece of information slip out. I don't know if he's going to be involved, but he said they, whoever they are looking at rebooting the Best of the Best franchise. Do you think this is a franchise that's better left? I mean, you know, the first film was 89, but we're just going to round up to 90. Better left in the 90s, or do you think this can work today?
I would like to see Best of the Best 5, personally.
I want to see Tommy Lee fight vampires.
Yeah, I'm fine with just keeping the Tommy Lee story. I don't necessarily need a reboot for this, because it'll end up, you know, looking like a step-up movie or something. Yeah. So, and maybe they'll, you know, maybe they'll puss out and make the bad guys in the first one South Korean instead of North Korea. Oh, okay. Yeah. So, no, I wouldn't mind. I will definitely check out if they do a reboot of this, but I would really like to see a part five, even if they just did a Best of the Best : so-and-so, because they're kind of doing that with three and four and giving us subtitles instead of numbers. But, you know, I'm okay with that.
A reboot could work. I would also rather them do a sequel, you know, continue with Philip Rhee's adventures. Maybe now his parents are alive and he has three divorced wives and two half American children or something.
And he's the president.
And he's the president. You know, yeah, they can retcon his history again. I mean, why not? I'd rather they kind of continue with that, because more than likely, if they're going to reboot it, they'll probably go back to the first movie and they'll do the whole tournament angle. And I don't really see that going over quite as well as that was, you know, the popular thing in the 80s. I don't know. I don't know if a karate tournament is going to be that big of a deal anymore. I mean, right. We'll see. I mean, it's kind of cool that they're, you know, even taking such a small franchise and bringing it back. But I guess when you look at the fact that they're bringing back just about everything as a reboot or remake or something or another, then it really shouldn't be that surprising. But I mean, I'd watch it. I mean, it would be cool if they did something like make Philip Ree one of the coaches or something, or a trainer, or, you know, have him involved in some capacity. I'd like that.
Narrated by James Earl Jones.
Nuts to a reboot. I want to see Tommy Lee in space.
Yes.
That's
fighting
it. That's
vampires,
that's it.
On the moon.
Yes. Space
and
vampires.
Coolio.
And
no,
Eric
no,
Roberts
don't
returns
bring
as
up
a side.
Don't bring up Dracula 3000. No.
Coolio the vampire in space.
And they should bring back a bunch of the actors, but have them play different people. Like, you got to have Eric Roberts as like a cyborg. Chris Penn as like the voice of a computer. Just like,
can't do that.
Yeah. You do know Chris Penn's dead, right?
Oh, shit, he is?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, I don't really keep up with current events.
Or maybe you could create a Chris Penn in the computer, kind of like the, you know, older Arnold Schwarzenegger from this new Terminator film.
And then all of a sudden, Chris Penn's like, my brother always overshadowed me. No more.
Lawnmower Man 3.
Lawnmower Man 3, best of the best 5.
Yeah.
And machine.
Best of the best 5 Lawnmower Man 3 crossover. You know what?
We got
I would
it.
Pay
we got
to
our
see
sequel.
That. I really would. All right. We've been dicking around. But what it comes down to is, I think this is an overlooked franchise. The films, even the fourth one, are worth it. And so many people don't know about the sequels. And I think more people should go and check out these movies. They're worth it. 3 and 4, I'll admit, are a little hard to find because they only were released on a double DVD set with one another that also had small distribution. So it's kind of hard to find. No Turning Back and Without Warning.
I had some trouble tracking those down, yeah.
You might have a little bit of trouble with those, but I think they're worth it. If nothing else, just the stellar casts and all these things. You need to see these movies, and they don't deserve to be forgotten. Speaking of not deserving to be forgotten, Mike White, where would people go to not forget you?
Don't you forget about me. No, 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 no. I'm over at projection-booth.com, and I swear my voice doesn't sound this bad all the time, but it has for the last little bit.
He's been pretending he's Tom Waits for the last week.
That's right. Let me tell you about a time when there was this prostitute who came into a bar I was at in Minnesota.
If we do want to forget Cecil T, where could we go there?
You can forget about me all the time at goodbadflix.com as well as geekjuicemedia.com.
And Cecil is way better than Chris Stuckman. There, I said it.
Aww.
And then Peter, you Canadian, you... Jason Hell yeah. Voorhees. You know what? You would probably go down on Kane Hodder. Where could people see that happen?
Well, if you want to see the best of the best of Canada, you can find me on Twitter at Cinematica. You can find me on Facebook, The Cinemasochist. You can find me on YouTube, The Cinemasochist. And you can find me in an alley blowing Kane Hodder.
You can find me at 1201beyond.com. Contact the show at 1201beyond@gmail.com. And go and buy a t-shirt or click on some links or buy something to stick up your butt and use the promo code DROME. And remember, the best of the best is the best of the best, but your best of the best may differ from our best of the best. Just remember, best of the best. I can't believe I did that without screwing it up. Have a good night.
Can you see us? Cause we rise, we live to Radio Drone is a 1201 Beyond production. Visit 1201beyond.com for more great shows.